It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, some philanthropists and billionaires are working to solve the world's oldest problem, death. We'll talk to a doctor and philosopher about the ethics of living a much longer life.
If you could live forever, or even for a whole lot longer than our current lifespan, would you want to? Is death a problem to be solved through science and medicine, or should it remain forever as a part of the human condition?
Now, for almost all of human history, these were just rhetorical questions, apart from rumors of a fountain of youth, legends of vampires, mortality, just part of the deal. But now, some billionaire donors are funding cutting-edge research that aims to dramatically prolong human life and to deal with death as a problem to be solved, not as an inevitability. According to the Washington Post, one funder, Larry Ellison, has expressed his hope that he could live forever. He's put over $400 million into the research effort.
The question is, would you really want to live dramatically longer, or even forever? And how would longer lives change our culture and our society? Here to explore the issue is Dr. Richard Gunderman of Indiana University, where he's a professor of medicine and philosophy. Dr. Gunderman, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's nice to join you again.
Well, as a physician, what do you make of some researchers trying to solve what they're calling the problem of death?
Well, for one thing, I find death a useful deadline to have in life. As a as a professor and years before that as a student, I know deadlines were one of the most helpful tools I had to get my work done, and I suspect if I had an infinite amount of time to complete the projects in my life, I might get very little done. So, for one thing, I think having that deadline gets us living with some sense of urgency. And I think another advantage, so to speak, in facing the prospect of our own mortality is that it gets us thinking about purposes in life that transcend our own lives. You know, the legacy we want to leave to our children, our grandchildren, our neighbors, and perhaps even to humanity. If we expected to be here forever, that whole issue of leaving a legacy might not even arise.
What about the way it's being framed by some researchers as a problem? Is that the right way to think about it, or is it just really a natural part of life?
Well, I spend a good bit of my time taking care of patients and using very sophisticated pieces of imaging machinery. I'm a radiologist, so I'm not an enemy of technology, but I'm also inclined to take seriously statements like, for example, in the book of Psalms, in the Bible, it says, "Teach us to number our days that we might gain a heart of wisdom." I think behind that is the notion that if we recognize our own finitude, the limitations on our own lives, we might be in a better position to live wisely.
Yeah, you use the word wisdom there, which a lot of people, not all people, but a lot of people would say is one of the goals of life, to gather as much wisdom as we can over the years. Do you think that would go away if we had an infinite number of years?
I certainly worry about that. The 20th century poet T.S. Eliot said, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" I worry sometimes that we live in an age glutted by information, but with an especially severe shortage of wisdom. And I think the idea that we'll just avoid death might prevent us from considering some of the most important challenges and questions that we human beings need to face up to.
I think a lot of people would agree that they'd like to avoid pain in particular, because it's so unpleasant. Do you think it's a given that most people want to avoid death?
I think one of the reasons people are uncomfortable with death is in this day and age, many of us have never seen it before. There's a great deal to learn from being at the side of somebody who's dying. And, you know, for much of human history, people died at home with their families. These days, we've tended to move death out of the home into places like hospitals and nursing homes and even hospices. So for many of us, death is a great unknown. And so that alone inspires fear. And then add to that to the problem that, as you say, many are afraid of dying in pain. Now, I have to say, in medicine today, we have a lot of tools at our disposal to prevent people from dying in pain. Another big fear dying people have is that they will die alone. And, you know, often we can assure patients and family members that we will be with them as they're dying. So I think there's a lot we can do to take away both the mystery and the pain and suffering associated with death. I'm not suggesting we can make it go away entirely, nor should we, but it doesn't need to be such a hulking mystery as it is for a lot of people today.
Why do you think it has been this persistent quest, though? The Fountain of Youth, myths about vampires, all of that. Why do you think it's been a goal for people to want to do this?
Well, you know, death is one of the great mysteries and one of the great challenges of life. Of course, it's not just a human challenge. So far as we know, every living organism is programmed to die. But the fact that we're conscious, you know, that we're aware of our existence and think about the future, I think it's a problem for us in a special way. And, you know, from my point of view, if we misapprehend the role of death in our lives, we're liable to be very afraid of it and to make some mistakes in life as a result. On the other hand, if we understand what death is and understand what it might contribute to the meaningfulness of our existence, you know, I'm not saying any of us should rush headlong toward death, but we might be a good bit more comfortable with it and might discover it has a whole lot more to teach us than we commonly suppose.
Right now we're talking with Dr. Richard Gunderman about the ethics of living a longer life as wealthy donors support scientific efforts to treat death as a problem to be solved and to maybe radically extend human lifespans.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Would you want to live a much longer life than our standard lifespan? How about forever? How do you see extending human lifespans changing the way our society works, the way we function as individuals, too? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to philosopher and physician Richard Gunderman of Indiana University about the ethics of living a longer life. With some massive donations into research aimed at dramatically extending life and even solving the problem of death.
Taking your calls, too. How do you think extending human lifespan would change society, change our culture? Do you think it's a good idea for researchers to pursue death as a problem to be solved? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We have Judy on the line from Waukesha. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
I know right now that we have major issues because of the mental health treatment or non-treatment and the addiction non-treatment. If we could successfully treat everyone's problems so that they would want to live another life or a longer life, then it would be successful. But I think that they are so miserable and they cannot cope with the life that they have right now, and we don't do anything about it. That's why we have many of the shootings that we have, both on both sides, police and the people that are being shot.
Judy, thank you so much for your thoughts there. And Dr. Gunderman, she says mental health is an issue, so she thinks a lot of people would not want to live forever because we haven't done enough to take care of people's issues here in our normal human lifespan.
I think Judy makes a good point, and this is one that I've heard echoed by Bill and Melinda Gates, that before we, those of us who are very well off, spend a lot of money trying to prolong our own lives, we should have first attend to the needs of less fortunate people who may not have enough to eat or who are focusing diseases and homelessness and so forth, that we owe it to them to help make their lives better before we try to prolong life indefinitely.
We're going to go next to Sam. Sam joins us from Fond du Lac. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
Hi, what are your thoughts on this?
First I just want to say that I'm having one of those driveway moments right now.
Great.
But anyways, I kind of agree with the last caller in the fact, in the sense that I feel like it's just kind of a misappropriation of resources. I mean, there's people, you know, that don't have access to clean drinking water, you know, to live forever. And, you know, that's really not something to be afraid of. It's going to happen, you know. That, you know, that's what happens. You die, something else takes your place, you know. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you so much, Sam, for that. And, Sam, you're looking at the planet, resources, problems of pollution we haven't solved, and maybe fear of death, he says, is the bigger issue, not death itself.
Yeah, I think Sam's point, again, is a very good one. We face lots of problems in our day-to-day life now. One is what to do with a rainy Saturday afternoon. So before we try to prolong such experiences forever, I really think we could make a better use of the time we have available to us right now. And the fact that that time is not unlimited may, in fact, lead us to live with a sense of urgency, a sense of seizing every day and making every day count that could disappear if there's no end in sight.
Even though you, Dr. Gunderman, you put a premium on wisdom, on a life well-lived, on living with urgency, don't you find something seductive about the idea that maybe you could have not one or two careers, but three careers, that you could become a concert pianist, that you could, you know, explore relationships that you never have the chance to within your normal, you know, allotted 80, 90, whatever years? Isn't there something appealing about it?
Yeah, this is in fact the theme of, I think, one of the most philosophically sophisticated films to come out in the last few decades, namely Groundhog Day. You may recall that was directed by Ivan Reitman, I think, but anyway, starred Bill Murray. And, you know, he had the opportunity to live one day over and over and really to try out everything. And the notion was he eventually figured out what counted most in life, namely his relationship with a particular person. I don't doubt that it might be great to have a chance to experiment and try on a bunch of different lives, but I'm also concerned that that might lead us to lead with a certain kind of frivolity, as the character in that movie does, and that, in fact, having that deadline, knowing we can't make all the choices, I think leads us to make much more well-considered choices and then really dedicate ourselves to making the most of the lives we've chosen.
We're going to go back to our callers now. Rebecca joins us next from Pewaukee. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I hate to echo everyone else, but it is, you know, one of those things where we're focused on longevity rather than quality, you know. And I worked in a nursing home for a little while, and there was, you know, you got to see a bunch of seniors at late 80s, early 90s that could never get out of bed without assistance. And, you know, they're living, but, I mean, to what quality?
Right. Thank you so much for that, Rebecca. Appreciate that. I know that's something that you've thought about, Dr. Gunderman. If research were able to make sure that our bodies were strong and healthy, would it become more worth it to you to live longer?
Yeah, well, that's a great point that Rebecca makes. And in fact, Peter Thiel, whom you quoted, and Larry Ellison, these are tech billionaires, the tech titans who are investing a lot of money in extending life. They clearly don't want to just prolong senility or dementia. They have in mind to extend, you know, vital life when mental and physical powers are at their peak. But, you know, whether that's possible is an open question. But what worries me even more about it is I'm worried that people who thought they were invincible, invulnerable, might lose something important that makes us human, namely our sense of compassion. I think it's in part the fact that we are vulnerable and that we do know our lives are coming to an end that enables us to feel for other human beings. And in fact, not just for human beings, but other creatures, you know, like even our pets. The fact we share that mortality, I think, enables us to be empathetic and to care for other people and other creatures in a way that might be much more unlikely if we weren't mortal beings ourselves.
And we leave it there. Dr. Gunderman, thank you so much for joining us. That was Dr. Richard Gunderman, professor at Indiana University. He was with us to talk about the ethics of maybe living a longer life.
Educators, politicians, and business people are taking computer coding pretty seriously. President Obama has asked all Americans to give coding a shot and has encouraged high schools in particular to teach computer science.
A group of entrepreneurs in the Chippewa Valley are picking up that challenge. This summer, the Evercode Foundation is launching a coding camp aimed at teaching kids in K-12 schools.
Here with us now are two of the founders of the organization. Garrett Denny is the president of the Evercode Foundation Board of Directors and Marketing Manager at the Wisconsin Independent Network. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Ben Strowinski is the owner and creative director of Satellite 6 and vice president of Evercode. Ben, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Well, let's start with you, Garrett. What is a computer coding camp? What happens there?
So the genesis of this was about a year ago, year and a half ago, when a couple of entrepreneurs, Ben was key, Jamf Software also, and the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, started to talk about how we equip that next generation of student to be competitive in the market today. And so much of what we do is revolving around applications, the Internet of Things, and connected devices, that you really need to be equipped with those coding skills. That's where this started.
And Ben, give me the pitch as though I were one of the kids, the target audience here. Why do I want to learn how to code?
Well, again, just like Garrett said, there's so many different connected devices and things happening on the web these days. One of the big things that I think Evercode and a coding camp brings to the table for kids is that it enables their creativity. It gives them new skills with which they can explore and kind of play with the media that's out there.
Is there a set of prerequisites, something that the kid needs to go before showing up for this computer camp, this coding camp?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is no. What we really want to reach are the students that have never been introduced to formal coding education. They look at their iPad or their Xbox and they see magic happening, and you want to kind of get under the hood, right, and see how that hot dog is made. So Ben can actually speak to this really in depth, but yeah, we want to reach students that have never had exposure.
Yeah, Ben, go ahead, Ben. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say that's basically our mission. In this case, we're really trying to give kids that sort of foundational level of code, give them a basic understanding of how URLs, how HTML structure all works together, how you can create a website from basically nothing, and give them the opportunity to really play on the web.
And Ben, is the thought here that every single student who comes to this is going to end up in the world of programming, or is there benefit for knowing this stuff, even if that's not our career down the road?
No, I don't think everyone's going to end up a web developer, but I think just having the foundational knowledge of the role that code plays in our current society and our current media mix is very helpful for a variety of careers, especially what we see in marketing and we see in other media endeavors.
Now, when I look at code, I've done very little of that in my life, but it looks like, maybe an alien language. I recognize the characters. I don't recognize the structure. Is this really hard? Is the barrier to entry really hard to overcome here, Garrett?
That's a fantastic question, and I think what's really important to remember, especially when we're talking about elementary or middle school students, when you want to get introduced to this, is we're not focused just on the language of code. It's what that code can accomplish as a tool. So we really want to blow open the world of developing the next Facebook or the next piece of video game software and give these students the power to start creating. I think that is so key.
We're talking to Garrett Denny and Ben Strowinski. They're both involved in the Evercode Foundation, trying to get youth in the Eau Claire area, the Chippewa Valley, to try their hand at coding for the various high-tech devices, the internet that we have, and maybe making a difference in their lives down the future. And let's look to the future, Ben. Is the idea here that maybe some of these students will grow up and go into code and start businesses of their own, maybe in the Eau Claire area?
Well, I think that's one of our missions with Evercode Foundation is to try to keep the interest level high in tech jobs, and especially in the emerging tech market in the Chippewa Valley. I think one of the really exciting things that we're going to do with this initial program is get these kids kind of walking through and touring all the different entrepreneurial groups, all the different businesses that are part of the foundation. So these kids are going to get a chance to tour Satellite 6 and Win and tour Jamf and get a real sense of the different kinds of careers they can pursue if they want to get into technology.
Now, we see in the news pretty often controversy in the tech industry being criticized for being a men's game, kind of, mostly white male, for that matter. Are you trying to overcome that with Evercode, Garrett, and bring in a more diverse crew?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge initiative. And to your point, it's a huge problem in the technology industry as a whole that you see a pretty homogenous population working in that field. So we do want to bring in diversity. We're actually fortunate. Partnering at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, they have a program called Blue Gold Beginnings that does stellar work, not just for coding, but they're a key partner in this code camp. And what's really nice is we're reaching an audience that's already 50, 60% female for this coding camp. So we have an audience built in from the get-go. That's just fantastic, in my opinion.
Now, when I think of the technology industry, I think of rapid change. I did a little coding work in my high school years. It used a program called BASIC. I don't think they use that anymore. So, Ben, given that it's a moving target, how do you make sure that the skills students are learning is going to be relevant, you know, when they hit the job market, say, in 10 years?
Well, I think our goal is really the foundational knowledge. And so, you know, your BASIC code may not be applicable to today's market, but what it does is still gives you some syntactical information, some idea of how coding structures and coding languages work. And so whether or not, you know, we're still using HTML and CSS, which I'm sure there will be some evolved form of that in the next 5 to 10 years, but whatever we're using, it still gives us students that initial exposure and an understanding of how these sorts of programming languages work.
So what are good stepladders into the world of coding? I've seen actually essays written that I mentioned the BASIC language. That was pretty basic. It wasn't too hard to learn. A lot of the stuff today is much harder. It's much harder to get into. Are there good stepping stones for people, even if they're not going to a camp like this, that might be good first baby steps toward coding?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say if you're looking at really young ages, you know, maybe under the age of 8 or 7, something like that, and you want to introduce the basic concepts of what you're trying to do, head over to code.org. They're another nonprofit that works in this space. They're huge nationwide, and they've got some great tools in the form of games using Flappy Bird and Clash of Clans that they've partnered with. Above that age, you know, when you start getting into that 7-8 range, I think you can really start pressing into web development. And this is our hope, that we equip these kids to build their own web page. They can take it home, show it to mom and dad, and have a project that they've completed.
Ben, talk us through just the logistics. If a student in the Eau Claire area signs up for this camp, what happens? Where do they go? What do they do?
Well, they're going to be at the university. They're going to be through the Blue Gold Beginnings camp. This is sort of our pilot program, so we're really interested to see how it all works. But it's going to be an overnight camp. And what they'll do is in the morning get up and go and code for a few hours and get that foundational knowledge going, and then they'll have some opportunity to kind of have some free code, I think, later in the day, maybe later in the morning. But either way, and then later on in the week, they'll actually get to, like I said, tour the different facilities and kind of see what careers in code would look like. And then they'll come back, and at the end of the camp, the goal is to have everyone that has their own little web project up and live for, again, parents and other people to check out.
Now, I understand there's supposed to be a boot camp for coding in Milwaukee called Ward 5. It was going to be the first computer coding boot camp. The opening was delayed because the Educational Approval Board said it had to register for a kind of regulatory oversight. Have you had to deal with the Educational Approval Board? Is that a hurdle here?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it really speaks, and Ben would echo this, I'd be sure, that it speaks to how important our partners at UW-Eau Claire and in the school districts in Eau Claire have been. You know, we're trying to bring this thing to a population that needs it, that wants it. We've seen a huge response to it. So to just reach out, kind of put this pilot program out there and have the response that we've had from partners that want to be a part of this movement is so encouraging. So we haven't encountered that yet. I don't think we're trying to do the same type of thing that Ward 5 is. So we've maybe avoided some of those regulatory hurdles, but we're really fortunate to have those partners.
And Ben, are you basing this idea on something from somewhere else, or are you just kind of blazing a new trail here?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen that coding camps have cropped up around the U.S., and it's become kind of an awareness thing where people understand that coding education is important in our schools and in extracurriculars. But for us in the area, I think it was just a real opportunity to take that general idea and really build some specific programs out of that.
And Garrett, as we wrap up, is it important for the economy of a country like the United States, a region like the Chippewa Valley, to have people have a hand in coding?
Yeah, I think it's critical. You know, you look ahead 10 years, 20 years, and the best guess is that the innovation in technology is what's going to continue to drive that economic growth. So we want to be a part of that, and we want to bring it to the Midwest. It doesn't need to be just the Silicon Valley. You don't need to move to California. We have tech companies, smart individuals, and great partners right here in Wisconsin, and we want to bring that here.
All right, Garrett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for your time.
And Ben, thanks to you as well.
Thanks a lot.
We've been talking to Garrett Denny and Ben Strinsky of the Evercode Foundation. They've created a camp to teach kids in the Chippewa Valley area how to program computers and all the high-tech devices that are replacing the old-fashioned computers.